is an interview with Jay Cone Jr. This is February 26, 1982 at the Franklin Library. Mr. Cone is the grandson of the founder of Cone Brothers, which is the oldest company in Des Moines outside of Yonkers and L.H. Kurt. And he's going to begin by telling us a little bit about the beginning of Cone Brothers.
Thank you, Cheryl. The Cone Brothers was founded in 1873 by my grandfather, Isaac Cone, and his brother, Josiah Cone, who came to Des Moines in April of 1873, arriving here, believe it or not, on the old K&D or Keokuk and Des Moines Railroad from Keokuk by train in an April snowstorm. This I know because I saw a letter from my grandmother that described this particular trip. They were on a sleeper overnight from Keokuk, and the sleeper was very crude, very rustic, and one of the few in existence at that time, was heated by a pot-bellied wood-fired stove. They came to Des Moines and lived temporarily at a hotel that was called Des Moines, which was spelled D-E-M-O-I-N House, down on Court Avenue for several months, and then bought a house up on 6th Avenue, just about 6th and, which would be about equal to 6th and Center Street, where they lived for several years. My grandfather and his brother started with a little one front store at I think it's 117 or 119 Walnut Street, just across the street from where the old post office was. It's now the county courthouse building. They had the kind of a grocery store that specialized in coffee and tea and extracts and seasonings and flavors, and but still had staples like sugar and flour and things of that kind. But they were disappointed in the quality of the spices that they could find from normal sources, because at that time black pepper, for instance, was partially made of ground black walnut hulls. And this was not in accordance with what they thought was proper, so they decided to go into the spice business, and which they did, and gave up the grocery business, and then went into the coffee business and the importing of teas, and started the firm of Cone Brothers still in that year of 1873. The company stayed in the family up until 1968, at which time it was purchased by Mid-Continent Industries, which in turn in 1978, I believe it was purchased by Universal Foods. Mid-Continent was purchased by Universal Foods. About 2 years ago, Universal Foods sold it back to a private individual. I have been with the company up until January 1st of this year, at which time I've been completely retired and have no more say in the operation or what goes on, but it's been a wonderful experience.
One of the things I read that your company did was start the pressurized can for coffee, and you know anything about that?
Yes. Cone Brothers did originate what they call the pressure pack coffee. They were the first ones to develop this particular packaging process, which the machine was invented and actually built by hand by my father and his brother, Mr. Fred Itone, who was with the company at that time. They felt that rather than a vacuum process, which drew the air out, if they could have a pressure pack process. It would be a better process, and then it would preserve the natural oils and the roasted coffee in better shape than the vacuum. This was proved to be true by all kinds of tests, but they had a little misfortune in that they started packing and selling it, marketing it just shortly before the war, and within a year or two after they got it on the market, the wartime regulations for World War II prohibited packaging coffee in cans. So it was not possible, it was too dangerous to pack the pressure pack coffee in jars, which we did switch to on a vacuum, go back to the vacuum process, because the jars, under pressure, they're afraid if they drop, they might explode and cause damage to children or to people who haven't dropped them accidentally. There wasn't glass at that time strong enough to be sure it would hold the pressure, because the pressure did mount up to several square inches per pound, and it they just thought it was too dangerous. But the pressure pack process was later bought by Chase and Sanborn on a royalty basis from the company, from Tone Brothers, after the war, and they pursued it on their pressure pack basis up until, I think it was probably 10 years ago, probably in the early 70s, at which time they gave it up because it required a heavier can than the normal pressure, vacuum pack can, and therefore it was more expensive. So they gave it up for competitive reasons.
I also read that at the time you first started making the coffee and selling it, rather, that people were not used to buying roasted coffee.
No, that's true. The housewife used to buy coffee in the green bean, in the whole bean, take it home, put it in her oven, and roast it in small quantities themselves, bring it up to the proper color that they wished by putting it on what we now term as a cookie sheet or a flat pan, and roasting it in the oven at about, of course they didn't have thermostats in those days when they were all wood or coal stoves, but they roasted themselves and then ground it with old little hand grinders that they had in their kitchen, and they would grind just enough for a pot at a time every day. But this became somewhat cumbersome, and the housewives wanted something that was easier for them to use, which developed into the ground coffee and the 1 pound and 2 pound containers that. I can't give you an exact date as to just when that transition took place, but for many years, coffee was sold green, and the common size was a 5 pound Kraft bag that they used to sell the green coffee in, which was sold, you might be interested in learning, even the some of the better coffees were sold around 18, 19.
20, 21, 22 cents
a pound.
Oh, boy.
Actually, at one time, we had a very low-grade coffee that was sold during the Depression due to the, as everybody knows, the lack of available hard change during the Depression years of the 30s, that we sold that the retailer could sell for 13 cents a pound, roasted in 1 pound bags. And we sold it so that they could sell 3 pounds for 35 cents.
Where were you getting your coffee then? Same place that they are today?
Yes, coffee is primarily from South America. The better grades of coffee are from South America and Central America. In a comparatively recent development in the last 30 years has been coffee grown in Africa. The African nations, Nigeria for one and Libya for another, started to grow coffee because their climate and their soil was adaptable. But unfortunately, the flavor is not as good. It's a little bitter, and not as palatable and not as acceptable generally by connoisseurs, shall we say, as the South and Central American coffees. But it is quite generally used. The African coffee is quite generally used now, blended with the Brazilian or the Colombian or the Mexican coffee.
You were doing a lot of selling, I read, to grocery stores.
Yes.
You must have seen a lot of changes then.
I did. My first job was at Tone Brothers was working in the shipping room, which was when I was in high school in the summers, which was very interesting. You may be interested. We unloaded, our coffee came in to Des Moines in boxcars. We buy a boxcar full at a time, which contained about 30,000 pounds, between 30 and 38,000, depending upon the particular coffee. And Stone Rose had a big, heavy dray wagon with a beautiful pair of horses and a driver, and this driver would unload $250 to $300 bags of coffee in a 2-day period all by himself. He was a great big strong husky man who could pick up 135-pound bag of coffee under each arm, carry it out of the car, put it in the wagon, load the wagon, and drive it to Tone Brothers and unload the wagon and put them on the floor at the plant. And I used to marvel at that man, that, and he just thought it was just a piece of cake. He didn't think there was anything to it at all. But I'll remember those horses very well. Oh, they were beautiful. He took great pride in them. He owned the horses himself, so he took great pride in them. They were beautiful horses. But then after that, after graduating from the University of Pennsylvania, I wanted to, like most everybody during those times, except this was in 1930, which I certainly picked a very poor time to graduate. And as so many young college graduates feel, they want to set the world on fire. So I thought, rather than come back to Des Moines, I'd go to New York and get a good start there and see what happened. It turned out that this was the time when they were selling pencils and apples on the streets of New York City. Jobs were very difficult to find, but through my connection with the coffee business, I was able to finally land a job as a runner for a coffee importing firm. A runner's job was to take the orders that the importers received over to the docks in Brooklyn, where the coffee ships arrived and were unloaded, and to check the marks. Each bag has a particular identification mark stenciled on it, and to make sure that the shipment had arrived properly and that it was routed to the buyer in either Des Moines, Chicago, Cincinnati, or wherever it was bound. And I would check, make out the bill lading, and check that it was shipped properly and on time and so forth, and then bring the documents back to the importer's office, which was down in Lower Wall Street and right by Battery Park in New York City. And this was really quite an interesting thing, but New York in those days was no fun, particularly when you're lucky to have a salary of $25 a week, which is what I was making at the time.
But, a college graduate.
Yes, that's the way to set the world on fire. But anyway, after a while, I came back to Toll Brothers because the depression was getting worse as time went on, 31, 32, and in the summer of 32, it was very hot in New York, and riding back and forth on the subway was a terrible occupation because you were just wringing wet the time you got home. It was so hot, steamy, and uncomfortable. I said, this is no place. And wrote my father, asked if I could come back, and he said, sure, hurry up. And went on the road for Toll Brothers, covering the southern, south central Iowa, and north central, and northeastern Missouri, and southeastern Iowa, calling on stores. And this was great experience. Wonderful people. It's just the type of person who operated grocery stores in those days were just so genuine, so honest. They got to know me a little bit, why I could just go into the store and see what they wanted and present them with a bill, which sometimes, quite often, they couldn't pay. But say if they owed us $40 or $50, why they'd say, well, can I apply 10 on my account? And when you come back, why, we'll see if we can do a little better. But you might be interested, I think, in this period that I was on the road in 33 and 34, the accounts that we had, we lost a few from bankruptcy. But those who did stay in business, we didn't lose a penny on them. Everyone of them paid their bills sooner or later. And they were so friendly and so hospitable. I can remember one time when I was down in the hills of northern Missouri, and it was in the wintertime, and this inland town, they called it inland when they were off the railroad tracks at that time. They had started to snow, and this man said that, you're not going any place tonight, because there was no pavement, and very little gravel on the roads in northern Missouri at that time, and the hills were quite steep, and they were all clay hills. He said, you'll get about a mile and a half out of town. You'll be in the ditch, and then you'll walk back. So he said, yes, I'm not going to let you go, because I just know what will happen. I've seen it happen too many times. So he insisted I go to his house and stay with him. And his wife cooked us up the most wonderful chicken dinner, and they had three kids. And we played cards after dinner. Then when I told him I'd have to get up early because I would be running late on account of the delay and so forth. And he put me in bed in a great big fluff feather bed. But I fell in the bed and I thought, oh boy, this is the life. Yeah.
Life of a traveling salesman.
Yes. But it was a great experience and I enjoyed it very much. And I still, once in a while, run across it. Old friend that I used to know when I was traveling on the road. But it was a great experience, and you certainly got to know people. But I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Grocery stores have changed a lot since that time.
Yes, oh my, yes. There were no such things as supermarkets then. Everything was a small, usually a family store, what we call a mom and pop store, and both the wife and the husband and quite often the son or daughter worked in the store. And they ran the whole thing, and they did their best to take care of the people in the community. Of course, the grocery store in those days was quite a meeting place, and most of these communities were farm communities, and they were dependent on the farmer for their trade. And anybody would come in the door, why, they knew them all by the first name. They'd stop and visit a little bit, and then go on about their, they'd leave an order, and then say, we'll be back to pick it up, and they'd come back. And some was cash, but most of it in that time was on a monthly bill basis. But they had not nearly the assortment that's in the stores and the supermarkets today, of course, but it was all good food, and the stores were clean, and the people were very friendly, and they were very anxious to please their customers, and there was that little extra something of a personal contact that you had with all your customers. And it was a pleasure to see them operate. It really was. Unfortunately, many, many of those stores are no longer with us due to the supermarkets and the chain operations that are going strong today. And this gives the consumer a much wider choice. And the food is better processed, it's cleaner, a much wider variety. And the food industry's made tremendous strides in the last 25 years.
So it's given Tone Brothers an opportunity to expand.
Yes.
As far as different
seasonings. Yes. Right. We started out when I was selling on the road. We had 24 items for spices. Today there's about 120. And everything at that time we sold was cost the grocer. If he bought 100 pounds or more total, including coffee, tea, extracts, and spices, we prepaid the freight. And it cost him, in that amount of shipment, his spices cost him 60 cents a dozen or a nickel a piece, regardless of the variety. And they sold them all for 9 cents or a dime. Depending on whether you were a cut rate operator or service store. But that was just a flat price. Everything was 60 cents. And all varieties, they could do with pepper, cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, whatever. They all cost the same. We averaged out on it. It didn't cost us the same, but we averaged out on it. Still made a fair profit. But the Tone Brothers today is primarily... It really sells from coast to coast. The largest we are the company today is the oldest continuous spice and extract company in operation in the country. There was a firm in Boston up until 2-3 years ago that were superseded us, but as of now, Tone Brothers is the oldest continuous operation. Spice and extract company in the country.
Started right here in Des Moines.
Do
you have any idea why your family came to Des Moines?
Well, no, I don't. Actually, they were told that it was the golden era, and that it was going to be a growing community because of the rich farmland, which was becoming better known, and they thought it was just the land of opportunity.
Was there any trouble distributing any of the products in the railroad system here? Was it adequate?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was. It was quite good. We had daily service out of Des Moines on the Milwaukee and the Northwestern and the Rock Island and the CB&Q railroads. We used them all, and they all went to different parts of the state in the Middle West. And of course, nobody was in quite so much of a hurry then. We'd ship it on one day, and if it got there a day after tomorrow, why, that was fine. They didn't expect overnight service like you like to have. Now, sometimes it would take 2 or 3 days, depending on if you had to take an interchange of 2 railroads or 3 railroads before it was to its destination. But we didn't have any complaints about that. Sometimes in a real cold winter, and the switches get iced up, and it would be bad. Why, then there'd be delays. They of course didn't like that, but generally speaking, it was not a problem.
You said that you came back to Des Moines from New York in the 30s.
In the 30s, yeah, 1930s.
Depression era. What was it like in Des Moines then?
Well, Des Moines was I thought it was just fine after New York. I thought, boy, this was a garden spot. And having gone to a high school here, I still had a lot of friends in Des Moines. And it was, I thought, a good place to live. I still think it's a good place to live, or I would live elsewhere. And I think Des Moines is still growing. I think there are opportunities in Des Moines. As of the present time, the employment picture here is certainly not very good. But I do think that business will come back, and I think the opportunities for Des Moines are still very good, particularly if we become an agricultural business community. I think if we could get a large grain processing complex going in Des Moines, I think this would add a great deal to it. It seems to me it's a natural. The marketing of our farm products to me is going to be an important thrust for the future, and I think Des Moines is a natural center for that, where we are one of the major growing areas, certainly, and it seems to me that this is going to come. It's going to come. It will develop. I've raised two sons in Des Moines. They like it. Have grandsons now, and they like it. So I think Des Moines is a good place to live.
It looks like Des Moines. You've been active for a long time. You were president of the Chamber of Commerce in 1958, I believe.
1958, right. Yeah.
You were involved in some projects then that are similar to things that are happening now, trying to get more employment,
yes.
More industry.
Yes. Yeah, we had a development bureau at that time, which I was very active in. And there was just a piece in the paper yesterday that kind of brought tears to my eyes, because one of the companies that I was materially involved in and coming to Des Moines was the Parker Brothers Game Company. And talked to the company officials, and we had meetings with them, and we came within an ace of losing them on a small little detail, because somebody had slipped up in the overall presentation to check the water supply out there on I think it's Douglas, where they are.
That's where they began also?
Yeah, that's where they started, that's where they got. And they said, well, we're just not going to be able to move here because the water supply is not adequate, because we need quite a bit of it. They were doing their painting, and they were doing their polishing, and they had for their games and their boards, and they did need quite a bit of water, and wanted to have proper disposal of the waste, which was not very good out in that particular Urbandale area at that time. But we hustled around and found out that actually there was going to be a new water tower built and new water lines built, which would be coincidental to their building, their new building, and they thought that was great. They said, okay, fine, we have that, we'll come to Des Moines. So this was a good thing.
You were
I'm
trying
very
to
sorry.
Des Moines,
yeah.
Des Moines industry.
Des Moines, oh yes, yeah. Des Moines industry. Very, and it's, the workforce in Des Moines is excellent, really. I can testify to that from experience with Tone Brothers. And the people here are good producers. They're good, clean workmen and workwomen. Women are becoming more and more part of the workforce, and they're good. They're very good. I mean, we should give them more opportunities to work.
You were involved in a Mall Street, Walnut Street project at the time you were chamber president. It roped off or part of Walnut Street.
Well,
what was that?
This was just a temporary.
You're trying to kind of track.
This was a test idea that of a mall on Walnut Street. The merchants. Retail Merchants Bureau thought they would like to try it, and they did try it. It didn't ever fully materialize, and for what reason I just can't tell you, but there weren't enough backers who were thoroughly enthusiastic about it to want to make it work. I think it would have been a good thing still, because they were just going to have just the buses would be the only transportation on Walnut Street. And it would be a walking mall, and they had to reroute the traffic, which met some resistance. But I still think it was a good idea.
Skywalks now are trying to do a lot of the same thing.
Right.
Try to keep people downtown.
This is one reason why I think Des Moines has got a good future. I think the Skywalk system is going to be a great help to the development of downtown Des Moines as that expands and with the new Nolan Plaza and the Civic Center and now the squares, they're calling it, the new development is being built down between Walnut and Locust, between 4th and 5th, I think is going to be a major attraction for downtown Des Moines. And I think that, of course, will continue. I think for the next 5 years, we will continue to progress and have better parking facilities, have better shopping facilities, have better overnight accommodations, or possibly a new convention center downtown, or the remodeling of the Betts Auditorium. I think that's needed for Des Moines, and I believe that that will come.
You said that the parking needs to be taken care of. I read that you were concerned about that when you were president of the Chamber of Commerce, too. Traffic problems
traffic
down there. What
problems.
How was it different then?
Well, the street parking was difficult. They even parked on the street during the rush hour. And this was a very difficult thing to get the retail merchants to give up those parking spaces because they thought that was important to their business, which I'm sure it was. But when the parking was, it just had to be because the traffic was moving so slow. When the parking was all prohibited in the downtown area from 4 until 6 o'clock, the traffic moved much more smoothly and much more rapidly. And I think if this had been done a little sooner, it maybe our suburban malls would not have developed quite so rapidly. But I think there is evidence already, a rebirth of shopping in the downtown Des Moines area. Personally, I didn't have very much to do with the parking, although this was in a discussion stage when I was very much in the discussion stage when I was in the as president of the chamber in 1958.
Were there any other projects that you were involved in then?
Oh my! Most of it was in the development of new concerns, bringing new companies to
Des Moines. How did you sell Des Moines that time? What was its drawing card?
Well, what we did, we advertised. We'd advertise in the Wall Street Journal. We would advertise in the various periodicals. We would be in contact with these firms who were seeking who were hired by manufacturing companies to find locations. We were in contact with them constantly. We were asking them to bring us prospects of people who came to them, and then we in turn would go directly to the manufacturer with the representative that they had employed. Massey Ferguson was a good example of that, to get them to come to Des Moines when the solar aircraft plant decided it was sold and was moved out to California. And that
was the old Tech? Is that where Tech was?
No, this is where Massey Ferguson is now. Solar Aircraft built that building. They were at Tech High, the old Tech High building, and then they built a new building and moved out to the Fleur Drive location. And then they were purchased by another concern, and their headquarters and their plant was moved to California, leaving their plant empty. And then the drive was, there were a number of concerns that we talked to. I Tony better not mention their names because they might not like it. But we talked hard and fast and to a number of companies, and finally did get Matthew Ferguson interested, and they thought it was a natural.
You've been very active in Des Moines for all your years, and it sounds like you got that naturally. Your mother was quite very active in the city.
Yes, and my father was too, and my grandfather on my mother's side, who was the editor and publisher of the old Des Moines Leader newspaper, Mr. William W. Whitmer, William Wirt Whitmer, was my mother's father. And mother was very strong. She was an early women's writer, and she was very active in the Des Moines Women's Club. She was one of the founders of the League of Women Voters, and worked with the Board of Education. And actually, she even ran for state House of Representatives one year as a Democrat, and was soundly defeated. I can't remember who her opponent was, but he happened to be a Republican, and the Republicans were pretty, very strong in those days, much stronger than the Democrats. This was in the 40s. And she was rather soundly defeated.
She was pretty instrumental in bringing adult education to Des Moines.
Yes, she was one of the
getting
one
a Carnegie early, grant.
Yes, she was one of the early backers and very strong in that, and worked very hard in starting the adult education program. She was one of the pioneers in that. And she got to know Eleanor Roosevelt quite well.
Oh, really?
Eleanor Roosevelt came to our house when I was young.
Oh, tell me about it.
And she was here. She was brought out, for a special occasion. It was, I don't know whether it was one of the anniversaries of the founding of the Women's Club or something of that nature. It was maybe the 50th anniversary. Anyway, she was brought out here as the main speaker and gave quite a speech. And she came out to our house for a little, after her speech, kind of a little reception for the family had for a few of their old friends, among whom were Henry and Mrs. Wallace, were there. I remember them. And she was a very, very nice lady. Interesting and so well-mannered and so thoughtful, so kind. She was very highly regarded. As a result of that, my mother was invited to the White House, and she enjoyed that. She enjoyed that very much. She was very active in community affairs.
You had a lot of foreign exchange students living at your home?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Not a lot. We had several. I think we had four or five that came over a period of years when they were just starting that program.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that was, we had a little French girl, and we had a German boy, and we had one of the, I don't remember, was this Swedish or Norwegian? One of the, I believe it was Swedish. And they were just there for a few months, but it was very pleasant. They were difficulty with the language, naturally, but we tried to help them, and I enjoyed it very much, being somewhat the same age or a little older than they were. Quite an experience.
Someone in your family owned the second car ever in Iowa. That's
my father.
Your father?
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. I remember it very well. It was a locomobile steamer. And it was, of course, an open car. There weren't necessarily the closed cars at those times. Had a tremendous big wheels. And I was just a little bit of a shaver at that time. I think that was, oh boy, about 1909 or 1910. But I remember that they took me for a ride in it when I was, I must have been just a couple of years old, I guess. Bundled me all up, put me in the front seat, And my mother held me, and my father drove, and they had backseat drivers even in those days. Even they don't go so fast.
How fast was it?
Oh, I think about 20 miles an hour. But it was a, oh boy, it was a beautiful car. Dad was a great car buff. He had a, and his brother, Fred Tone, was an automotive engineer. He was the chief engineer for Dodge Brothers many years ago. So he was still part of this interest in cars of my father. And he drove the American Underslung in the race at Indianapolis, one of the early stages of the Indianapolis race. And that was that was a very high-powered car for his age, and a unusual in that cars now, they put the springs on top of the axles, and this way they put the springs under the axles and had them hang down so that they were lower center of gravity. And this was, they thought, was a great, great progressive move on the part of the car manufacturers. No, Dad was a great car buff, and he had an old Chalmers. Remember that? Hudson Super 6.
Just back in quick roads.
Yes, and some are even dirt roads. Yeah. And we lived on 29th Street at that time. And they did have a thing like, it was it was oil coated and then it was asphalted. And they had a little trouble keeping the pavement even. It seemed to develop holes, and this was always a constant source of concern. They even had potholes in those days. I think even worse than they have now are chuck holes, as they call them. What else would you like to know?
Well, there were things happened in Des Moines. Do you remember when the first United passenger plane landed here in 1940? That must have been a big deal.
Well, now, I think that it was before that. Actually, they had a Ford tri-motor plane that landed at the airport out in Altoona, which was, I believe, a predecessor of the United Airlines. I think United Airlines had their first commercial, but they brought in this Ford tri-motor. They were flying it around the country trying to sell it to the airlines. The airlines weren't much in those days, and I remember going with Dad out to the airport, which was then the airfield. They didn't call it airport; they called it the airfield, which was nothing more than a pasture out north of Old Highway 6 at Altoona, and it was a level spot with grass, and that was about it. And this big old tri-motor, solid metal plane, it had corrugated sides like the corrugated metal roofs, mm-hmm. made out of aluminum, early aluminum construction. And that thing made so much noise, you just couldn't believe it. But I remember that very well. And then that airport wasn't big enough, and they moved it to what is now Merle Hay Road and Douglas Avenue. And they're called Herring Field. This is when Clyde Herring was active with a Ford dealership here, and he donated the land for the airport. And I don't remember just exactly where United Airlines first lit. Was it at the present airport? Was the present airport
1940?
Developed in 1940?
Oh, it was their anniversary, I hope.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? So it must have been. Now, what was the anniversary? Was that? Was that the 50th that they just celebrated this last year? So it was 1930 that they did that? Yes, I remember when United Airlines came in with their first plane. But when you mentioned that, I thought, well, I don't believe that was the first passenger plane.
Not in the area.
Yeah. They had... I think one of the pilots or one of the flyers for that was Mr. Ed Butler, who was a friend of mine and who was my present wife's first husband. And he was a flyer in the service and went to United Airlines and then was there first when they opened a branch office here. He was their first manager of the branch office for a number of years. The airline industry has certainly been a great thing for Des Moines. Mm-hmm. We are strategically located, and it has certainly helped in the development and progress of Des Moines a great deal.
About 2 years after that, that they said that they had the highest amount of snowfall in a 24-hour period. We had 19.8 inches in from December 31st to January 1st. Do you remember what that was like?
Yes. Well, that was great fun. It was very difficult time for the speech department for the snowplows, which of course didn't have the equipment that they have today. But it, old Des Moines was mired down, I think, for almost a week.
Okay.
Yeah, things just, the streetcars didn't run, and the buses, I don't think, were operating. And people just stayed home. They just couldn't get out. But if you tried hard enough, why, if you didn't mind shoveling, you could make it.
On foot.
You could make it on foot, yeah. Yeah, that was quite a storm, but it really it slowed things down for a day or two, but it wasn't too serious.
Nikita Khrushchev was here in 1959. Were you involved at all with that?
Yes. Mr. Frank DePute was the head of the Chamber of Commerce that year. He followed me as the president, and we had worked on trying to get him over here. When I was active in the chamber, it had started, and the negotiations were very, very slow. They were difficult to get any firm commitments. Nobody knew much about Iowa and Russia, and they didn't know really whether this was safe, what really brought it about was Bob Garst from Coon Rapids had gone over there two or three times in the past and had met Khrushchev and had convinced him that he should come to Iowa. And I remember that one of the things that the sheriff and the police department were scared to death because they thought the security would be so difficult, and he made a speech down at the Fort Des Moines Hotel, and that place was just swarming with Secret Service people and our sheriffs and our policemen, and they were holding their breath. But it turned out all right, and I think this made a lot of difference. It certainly was a feather in the cap for Iowa, because as a result of that, our export trade with grain in Russia started in quantity, I think as a result of Mr. Khrushchev's trip.
Gave Des Moines a lot of publicity, too.
That's right. It sure did. It sure did. Absolutely. Yes, there's been, Des Moines had a lot of fortunate events that have happened here. I wish I could recollect anything in particular.
Well, it wasn't a fortunate event, but the flood of 1954 certainly was kind of a devastating thing, wasn't it? Did it affect your business at all?
Yes, we had water in the basement at Tone Bros. At that time, our plant was at 109, 111 Court Avenue, right across the street from the Kurtz Building, which is now the Kurtz Building. Used to be Lukey Hardware at that time, and all those buildings down in Court Avenue, we had 5 feet or more of water. It used to show people where the water line was in the basement wall. And we generated our own electricity. We had our own generator and our own steam boiler, and we made our own electricity in the plant. And of course, that got all flooded. And this was the main problem, is to get the boiler cleaned out. It was a steam generator run by steam. Get the boiler cleaned out so we could have electricity in the plant. And that took 2 or 3 days to get the plant back in operation again as a result of the flood. But I can remember working that night on the Des Moines riverbanks with a bunch of volunteers with sandbags. The boilers, almost everybody you knew was down there sandbagging the riverbank to try to keep the flood. And the worst part of it turned out to be was up by University Avenue. That got the lower part of above the dam quite well taken care of, and then all of a sudden it started to run over up there on the upper by University, where the Iowa Pipe and Tile Company used to be, where the armory is, the south and north of the armory, where the armory, all that ground in there was low, where the Botanical Center is now. And the water was starting to go in there just like crazy. They're going to get the whole Lower East Side there, but it got stopped before it got too far. But it was fun. It was an interesting experience. The volunteers really turned out, and they filled those sandbags and got them in place. They just had a chain gang going. It was very effective. It was one of those kind of miracle things that happens.
Did you have any outside help, like National Guard or anything like that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they had the National Guard. They had everybody imaginable was there. They brought in the fire department. Their off-duty firemen were there. And the off-duty policemen and city employees of all types and kinds, and volunteers and National Guard. And you name it. Everybody was working on that project.
It's a camaraderie.
Yeah, it was. It was.
I was going to ask you, you're really involved in the Des Moines Club, too?
Well, not in any official capacity, no. I've never been an officer in the Des Moines Club.
You've seen it change and move around a lot.
Yes. I was a member of the Hermit Club, which was across the street from the Des Moines Club in the old Rawson Block.
That's not in business now.
That's, well, the Rawson Block, you know, the Hermit Club. Then the Hermit Club. The way I got into the Moines Club was through the Hermit Club. In the 40s, the Des Moines Club was losing its membership, and they needed some new members, and they thought that the good thing would be to join hands with the Hermit Club, which was mostly young businessmen like myself at the time. So they made the suggestion. We had a meeting. The Hermit Club and the Des Moines Club members and officers and board. And it was an attractive proposition, so the Hermit Club dissolved and became part of the Des Moines Club, which I think was a good thing for both of them. And then the Des Moines Club, as you know, took a vote to decide whether to go to the Rouen building or not. When that came up, I still miss the old Des Moines Club. I thought it was a very, very nice, nicely run, quiet and stately place, and I think that was quite an asset to Des Moines.
They had a lot of people from outside of Des Moines come in and use it.
Yes,
yeah,
and they had very good food, very good service. And it was a little bit more like what in those days was quite well accepted as the top echelon of clubs, the Union League Club in Chicago and in New York and places like that. This was just a kind of a junior Union League club it had that kind of a men's club atmosphere. I remember they had several times they had. Votes regarding women, whether they'd even have women in there or not, and finally they That came through. Took a long time. A lot of the old timers were, oh no, this is a men's club.
What do you think finally brought about the change?
Oh, I think that just as younger people came along and their members, and they thought it was, it'd be nice to bring their wives down there.
Before that only men.
Yeah, have it a family club mm-hmm. as well as just a men's club.
Hmm.
So, progress. It's progress.
Your family's been supportive of the art center.
Yes, too. ever since it
Do you remember getting it started or anything?
No, I wasn't. Participating in that. My cultural education and acceptance for the fine arts was not at a very high degree during those times. But I did think it was a good project for Des Moines, and I did support it and helped them raise funds and. Some good friends of mine were very active in the board and so forth, but as I say, my what talents I may have had were not exactly in the artistic field, although my first wife, Valene Tone, was very active, but she was on the board for many years and did a very good job. She was, that was her prime interest for many years, and being an artist herself, she was very interested in the arts, and I'm sure performed great service for the mm-hmm. Art Center.
Do you know anything about the changing of the Rotary Club?
In the changing,
just the, how it's developed.
Oh well, what did how it has developed us. It started in Des Moines. I think we had our 50th, I believe it was the 50th celebration last year of the founding of the Rotary Club. No, it must have been before that. Rotary was founded, I believe, in 1927, and we were 2 years out. We were 29, I think. I don't, I'm sorry, I should have that information, but I don't have it at my fingertips. But it was a small group, and my father was a member of Rotary, and I'm a member of Rotary, and now my two sons are a member of Rotary, so it's been a family tradition. But I think they've done quite a lot for the city of Des Moines in a quiet way. Some projects that they have supported and have helped finance, and they are very strong in the student program, overseas student program, bringing students in to Des Moines and sending Iowa students to foreign countries. It's one of their main projects at the present time, and to me that's very important. If we could have a better understanding with our foreign friends, I'm sure there would be a lot fewer problems.
Started at home.
Yes, indeed.
Is there anything you want to tell future generations of people living in Des Moines?
Oh, I don't have any real sage advice on that, but I would say that Des Moines is fortunate in that It, I believe, has lost its hick town image that used to drive me crazy when I was going to school in Philadelphia and working in New York. They'd say, you live where? In Des Moines? I said, well, is that the other side of Pennsylvania? Anything west of the Hudson in those days was the Indian country. They really thought that out in Iowa that we had Indians riding across the plains and living in teepees. But that image is certainly gone, and I think Iowa and Des Moines in particular is now well respected as an educational center and as a transportation and distribution center, as a educational center for the whole state, actually. I think our state schools and our private colleges in the state of Iowa are a great asset, and this has certainly been portrayed by our high literacy rate of standing in the state for many years. And I also think that our preeminence in politics by having our early caucuses and early conventions and so forth has put Iowa on the map and made them people politically aware, and it's been a new center. I think when we had those debates here, I think it was a great thing. And people are much more aware of Des Moines and Iowa than they were before, and I'm all for that. I think it's a good place to live, as I told you.
Is there anything you came with that you didn't get to tell me?
Oh, no, I didn't have. I just brought some little things to about the company here, something that a little flyer that they put out in the old days that they put in their packages of tea. And here's a Daily Capital, September 1899, ad that Tone Brothers ran in the paper.
The packaging sure has changed over the years.
Oh my, yes, yeah. We actually started out, if you're interested in that, with what they had was just they got large rolls of craft paper, cut them into little squares, folded them around a block of wood, and then had a bin of spices, and they would take in those little cardboard boxes like that.
All packed by hand.
Yeah. Cannon brand was our trademark for many, many years. Yeah, Cannon brand was our trademark for many, many years.
Sure.
The cannon with a little stack of cannonballs there alongside. We still have a few of those that we saved out the plant. I've got a couple of them.
Given Des Moines advertisers, advertising a lot. Business.
Yes. Actually, we employed a national advertising agency, one of the major ones, NWA & Company in Philadelphia, for a period of about 4 or 5 years. And we advertised in the Saturday Evening Post. But we finally figured out that about 95% of that circulation was wasted compared to where we were selling it, because our market didn't cover near that much of an area. But it was a prestige thing, and it impressed our customers to see our ads for Tone Brothers and Saturday Evening Post. That was we used Saturday Evening Post, and then Collier's was very active at that time. Of course, we did advertise in the Des Moines papers all the time. Yeah.
You were bought by Mid-Continent. Was that to expand outside of the area?
Well, yes, to a degree. The greatest expansion of the company has been in what we call the food service area, where we sell to institutional wholesale grocers, who sell in turn to hotels and hospitals and restaurants and so forth. It's the large size package and the 5 and 10 pound packages and 1 pound packages. And that business has grown. We saw the opportunities in that several years ago and started working it very hard. And now we do have a national distribution, I think, in almost every. I don't think we have anybody in Maine at the moment. But we're in Florida and Pennsylvania and Ohio and New York and California and Washington and so forth. So, nationwide in the what they call the food service business, which in turn are the people who cater to the hotels and restaurants and the hospitals and so forth.
I think the era of the family-owned business is still.
Well, there are possibilities, yes. The problem is that these days it's a matter of financial support. And the financing of a major business these days is a very difficult thing right now. And, sure, there'll be some family business. There's still a number of them in Iowa. There's quite a few small agricultural equipment manufacturers that are still manufacturing. There's still family businesses, and I think will continue to be so.
Do you have any idea how much it costs to get Stone Brothers to start and open for stores and use Kinder Grocery?
Oh, no, I suppose $1,000. It's a fortune in those days. I saw some figures not too long ago. It's going through some things that are one of our first years in business, and I think the sales were $16,000.
That was good.
That was good. You bet. You bet. That was good business. Now it's well over the million.
How did you survive the Depression? Was that a hard time?
Very difficult. Very difficult. We were fortunately, we had good relationships with our bank. And then the banking situation in Iowa is before your time, Cheryl, I'm sure. But the banking situation in Iowa during the 30s was precarious, too. But fortunately, the company had some assets. They had my father and my uncle, Mr. Wiltone, who were operating the business at that time, were both quite frugal and quite conservative men. And they had accumulated some financial backing, nothing very great to be sure. But the company operated in the red for 4 or 5 years, and actually there was consideration on the part of my father and my uncle of liquidating the business at one time. But they finally decided, well, we've gone this far, let's go the rest of the way and do the best we can. But this was primarily because our customers couldn't pay their bills. We had the merchandise and we could do it, but we were going in the red because they couldn't pay us. And we hated to cut them off, frankly, because they've been customers for many, many years and they've been loyal to us, loyal to our brand. Well, actually, it paid off because, as I say, I was on the road at that time in the 30s. For years afterwards, when I even went after this, I was off the road, was in the office as a sales manager at the company for several years. Some of these old customers would stop by and they'd say, "We didn't never thank you enough for carrying us when you did." And they said, "We don't buy anything else but Stone products now, and it's because you helped us." Well, it did pay off. It did pay off. And also, I must say, in fairness, that the company was very strict on their quality. Very strict on their quality. They would not have any shoddy merchandise go out under their name. That's right. And that paid off, too. That paid off, too. But I'm trying to think of any particular special events. When I get in the car and go home, I'll be undoubtedly thinking of Cheryl. there was a entertaining or amusing or interesting. At the time, I know one thing was our company was we went through three different fires. This was the building at 109 111 Court Avenue, which you may be interested to know, was built in 1911 by my grandfather and his brother. They didn't have an architect. They didn't have a contractor. They drew their own plans. They supervised the construction themselves, bought all the materials, and drew the specifications up. And I'll never forget one day when Mr. Weiss of the Weiss Construction Company came down when the post office finally took over that land on Court Avenue to expand the post office. And we had to move. And then we moved over to 2nd Avenue just around the corner, south of the tracks there, which is part of the Youngers Warehouse building now, before we built our new land in 1971 out at the interstate. Where the two interstates cross, where 35 and 80 cross. And I'm deviating here. But anyway, I'll never forget when I was a youngster, the telephone rang, and my father jumped up, and he jumped on his foot in his clothes and ran out. And I said, well, I asked Mother what's going on. He said, the building's on fire, the company's on fire. And so we went down. Some neighbors heard about it. They came by, and it was like 10, 11 o'clock at night, and everybody was asleep. We're in downtown, and I was in my pajamas and a coat. And at that time, Brown Camp Hardware was the building next to us when they caught fire. But fortunately, my grandfather and his brother, when they built the building, had a 3-foot solid brick wall at the base that tapered out to a 2-foot solid brick wall at the top of the fourth floor, which is the height of our building. It heated up and cracked, but that wall never did give way, and the Brown Camp building was only a 4-story building. We were a 5-story building. And the Brown Camp building completely collapsed and fell into the basement. And they were pouring water on that wall and on our roof for hours and hours afterwards. But the only thing, we did get some water damage. We got some very heavy smoke damage. And again, water in the basement. Mm-hmm. But then later on, C.C. Taft had a building there. It caught on fire and it burned.
Right next door there.
Right next door, where Brown Camp used to be. Then they were burned out, and then the Thriftway headquarters was in there for a while, and they had a fire, and they burned out, and that wall stuck through all three fires. But after the Brown Camp fire, we had we had a sign painted of Tone's Coffee with a can tipped on the side. Five stories high, and from the street clear to the alley. It was the largest sign in the state of Iowa. Huh. And it went to the river. It was on the east side, the east wall. And we used to get kidded from the legislators because they'd look out of the Capitol and they'd say, well, don't they wish you start a Tone Brothers sign? But that was quite an accomplishment when we decided. I was instrumental in that, and putting this huge painted sign of Tone's Coffee on the side of the building. And I'm trying to think of dimensions of what that thing must have been. I think it was about 180 feet high by 320 feet long. And the sign painter, he said he was going to, well, I said, this will take us about a week. Well, it took him 2 months to paint the sign.
Well, that's
going
to happen. Yeah. You've been very visible.
That's right. There's some city chamber conference has some pictures taken from the state house. One of the main things you can see is this great mission. I'll go inside. We had a lot of comments about that. see if there's anything else I can think of, Cheryl, that might be of interest. Another visitor, our house when I was a kid was, I don't know whether you ever remember, Baron von Richthofen, who was the sea pirate, the sailing sea pirate. There was a story about him, and he was the during the First World War, mm-hmm. had this big sailing ship, and he would roam the seas and sink the enemy ships. And he was at our house.
How did he come to your house?
So this was after the war, mm-hmm. and he was not well thought of course for years, but in quite a number of years after the war, when he was older of course, and he became quite a romantic figure in literary circles. He wrote a couple of books about his adventures during the war and his pirating and what he did and how he did it. Why they could never find him, because it was a wooden ship and they, you know, the detection devices could find him. And how he would sneak up in the middle of the night and sink an enemy ship and then hightail it off and never be found. They never did catch him. Yeah. Never did catch him. But he was, oh God, he was a romantic figure, tall with a beard and a goatee and a captain's hat and uniform and all the gold braid, and he had a swagger about him, and he was really...
But he had a lot of stories.
Oh, did he ever. Yeah, he was stayed at our house one night, and I remember sitting on the floor just enraptured with this guy's tales of his adventures. It was great fun. Great fun. Oh, another thing I remember is when Herbert Hoover came to Des Moines, and speak at the old Coliseum when he was running for re-election as president during the Depression. And he got quite a cool reception, even though he was an Iowan. I remember listening to his speech, and my mother was an avid Democrat, but she... And my father and I and my sister went down to his speech, which he thought it was an historic occasion, which I think it was. And we met him afterwards, and I shook hands with him. But I was surprised. I remember even as a youngster at that time that people were walking out of there in a very kind of a sober attitude. They were not very enthusiastic about what he had said, and he had not received it. A heavy applause. So his program just didn't take with the people of Iowa, even if he was an Iowa boy. Well, I don't think of anything else at the moment. If you have any further questions that you'd like to ask about, Cheryl, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Fascinating.
Oh, one thing I would like to mention, I think that we are missing a bet. In being as our company was dependent on the railroads for transportation before they had the truck lines, I think truck lines are very important, but I do think that one of the things we as Iowans, and particularly citizens of Des Moines, should do is try to rehabilitate the Rock Island Railroad tracks and use them, because that right-of-way is certainly important to Des Moines, and it hurt Des Moines, I think, by not having good freight rail service. And I believe this is a project that should be very high on our list of things to do in making Des Moines, continue to make Des Moines a progressive city. Very much in favor of that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.